So from our Tehran headquarters, let's continue with this special rolling coverage on the occasion of the assassination of the Iranian top general, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Well, let me give you a brief history of what's been happening since Friday, when the early hours of morning when that assassination took place. There have been funeral processions in a number of cities and countries. It has started on Saturday from the Iraqi capital city of Baghdad. We had crowds of people there attending the morning procession. And then from capital Baghdad, it went all the way to the holy shrine city of Karbala. And after that, to the shrine city of Najaf, again, another shrine city in Iraq. So three cities and three different funeral processions held for General Soleimani and his comrades there in Iraq. And then the day after, on Sunday, we had live images for you here on Press TV. We're broadcasting live for you. The victims' coffins found their way to the southern city of Ahvaz there for a number of hours. We had that huge funeral processions, black-clad mourners there remembering the martyr and the hero of the anti-Daesh war, Qasem Soleimani. And from the southern city of Ahvaz, then after several hours, the bodies were flown to the holy Iranian shrine city of Mashhad. Then in Mashhad, we just hear that people were waiting for the bodies to arrive for several hours. Large millions of people out there on the streets of the holy city of Mashhad there on Sunday. And from there, it was supposed to, the bodies were supposed to be flown to Tehran in the evening, but they got stuck there because of the huge number of people over there mourning during the funeral procession there. And then finally, the bodies were flown to the capital city of Tehran. So today, this morning, we hear it took 9-10 hours for millions and millions of people in Tehran, converging on the streets in the down part area around the University of Tehran. And in the early hours of morning, around 9:30 in the morning, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, led some special prayer. We have an Islamic rituals for special prayers for the deceased people. And in the presence of a large number of Iranian dignitaries and political figures, and of course millions of people, residents in Tehran and from suburbs of Tehran, joined the Million March. And again in Tehran, it took many hours. We were 9-10 hours, and then the bodies were supposed to be flown to the holy city of Qom around lunchtime, but it just happened a couple of hours ago. We just hear that a lot of people even did not manage to be able to join the crowds on the streets. They were stuck in metro stations and bus stops underground, and they were not able to join the people on the streets. So huge crowds of people, something unprecedented. We had all reporters on the streets, and they were surprised. They said never ever in their lives did they see such huge crowds of people out on the streets in mourning ceremonies. So the bodies are expected to arrive in the city of Qom. It's getting dark there, but we have large crowds of people there also awaiting several hours for the bodies to arrive. And then tomorrow they will be flown to the city of Kerman, another Iranian city where the bodies will be put to their final rest. This is where General Soleimani was born, his hometown and birthplace. So that's the whole story about the funeral procession. Now, let's continue our discussion with our panelists and guests who are joining us from Westchester. Let me invite Don Debar, activist and commentator. Good to have you with us, sir. So let's begin with your comments on this. And let me read you something that Foreign Minister Zarif just tweeted. He said, addressing President Trump, I said, do you still want to listen to the clowns advising you on your region? And do you still imagine you can break the will of this great nation and its people? This is the end of malign U.S. presence in West Asia. It's just started. Let's have your take on that, Don Debar.
A very cogent and very wise way of stating the entire situation. First, he's essentially reminding us this isn't just Trump. This is policy of the United States. He doesn't go back to Mossadegh. and he doesn't have to, but certainly we have seen this policy implemented since the revolution in 1979 towards Iran. And we have seen the same policy, by the way. This was, you know, an infringement of the sovereignty, to the extent any exists, of Iraq. This took place in Iraq's territory, you know, providing diplomatic safe haven to an Iranian visiting official. And the U.S. has been violating Iraq's sovereignty since 1990-1991 on a daily basis, with a very large body count, I might add. That's the first part that I noticed. The second thing is that you have this dynamic that's in place that's a consequence of the suffering the United States has tried to impose on Iran that the sanctions bring, and that is the opposite effect that they intend. They intend to have people squabbling and, you know, basically a collapse of the society and the state with the sanctions. And what it's obviously doing with the millions of people in the street today is unifying the people there. And now what's really funny about it, it's not funny from the point of view of the suffering involved, but it's logically absurd. The larger context is that the United States actually cannot go to war with Iran because of the objective conditions that, in other words, the Trump administration cannot go to war with Iran because the Trump administration seeks better relations with Russia. If that latter part is true, it is not possible for the United States to seek better relations with Russia and to go to war with Iran at the same time. That's a condition the United States created. And further, the United States cannot go to war with Russia now, or risk war with Russia now, where perhaps they might have if they were crazy enough before, because they created a strategic partnership between China and Russia by attacking them both during the Obama administration. So, you know, they're saying this is a very provocative, stupid, crazy, war-risking move, and I think it is, but it's not unique by any means. Even over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen the things that set this up to, you know, where it's a major conflagration instead of just a local war, if it occurs at all. And I don't think it has to occur, by the way.
And Mr. Dandibar, and there is something that's happened. Maybe this is part of the repercussions of what some people call this idiotic or dangerous move that President Trump has made. And, you know, I'm sure you have heard that the Iraqi MPs, of course, they had been calling for this since long ago, but this kind of propped it up and then pushed them forward to go and sign a draft law. Around 180 MPs in Iraq yesterday, and they asked the government to try its best to start the U.S. troops pull out from Iraq. And okay, let's have your comments on that, and what other repercussions it could have for the Trump administration.
I think it's a very interesting move. First of all, I want to be very clear, you know, in completely condemning this. This is a violation of international law. It's a violation of the sovereignty of Iraq. Okay, again. However, that is barely unusual behavior for the United States government. So although I criticize it as, you know, on that basis, I've criticized it on an ongoing basis for doing that as policy, basically. That said, if you look at the, you know, what the administration said during the campaign, even Trump himself before for years about Iraq, it was one thing that well, we should have at least got the oil. But the salient point that he was making, aside from that ridiculous point, was that there shouldn't have been a war in the first place, that no one benefited from it, except some contractors who benefited very well on the backs of American taxpayers. And so, you know, there's a lot of that drew support for him and also sort of turned some heads of the Republican constituency on those issues and turn them from being, you know, more or less warlike to understanding that the U.S. policy should be peaceful and the, you know, everybody's better off with that. I saw this manifest at the RNC when he talked about ending these wars and getting a standing ovation, but this has been measured in polling data. So, however, how do you get from the condition that we've had with the U.S. occupation of Iraq to the U.S. leaving Iraq? When he talked about pulling 2,000 troops out of Syria, weren't even supposed to be there, the media, the Democrats, the whole political establishment, those 17 intel agencies, they're all going crazy. They were calling it treason that he was handing Syria over to the Iranians and to Putin, his puppet master, etc. So imagine the political hit he would take going into an election year for pulling out of Iraq. Now, if, however, well, so Iraq says pull out in this resolution yesterday.
Yep.
His answer wasn't no. His answer was, okay, you're going to have to write us a big check for the airport. I see a pathway there, possible. I don't know. Was that what they intended? Everyone says that everyone involved is either stupid or crazy, yet there's maybe a trillion or 2 trillion or how many trillions of dollars spent on all these 17 intel agencies and military intelligence and everything else. These things are conceivable to us that are looking from the outside. I'm sure some of this has occurred to some of the policymakers, and maybe it's possible there were people involved, you know, on all three sides saying this might be the way out, as ugly as it is, for all of us, presented with the thing that we inherited.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And Don DeBar, there are, you know, I'm sure you've heard about this tweet that President Trump posted the other day. I mean, he, in the first place, he didn't regret, I mean, having done this. He said, we should have done this many years ago. We should have murdered General Soleimani many years ago in the first place. And then he again kept threatening the Iranian nation. He said there are 52 targets that we have, you know, designated. And those 52 targets also include some cultural centers. I mean, noting the fact that Iranians care a lot about, you know, their cultural institutions and that kind of thing. And then we had the Foreign Minister Zarif responding that this is really is going to be a war crime if you attack our culture centers. And sure. We had another also Iran official saying that we had all 290 people killed. I mean, Trump referring to 52. That refers to the number of Americans taken hostage, if you remember, during the embassy takeover in Tehran. And then he said in response that those hostages were set free. None of them got killed. None of them got injured. But you killed more than 290 Iranians aboard a plane on, you know, over Persian Gulf waters.
Right into that. Okay. Yeah.
Let's have your take.
Yeah. June or July of 1988, I think. Yeah. Look, again, I don't want to seem like I'm, you know, excusing any of this. The reality is that that what we see come out of Washington and out of the Western capitals in general, always, but particularly for the last 3, 4, 5 years, is a virtual reality presentation of what's actually happening. There is essentially nothing but messaging that comes out of the mouths of the politicians and other authorities in Washington that's intended for some slice of the masses in the United States to, you know, either enlist their support for a particular claimed policy, because the policy usually has nothing to do with the discussion of policy, or to have them attacking some other group that supports or opposes it. In other words, to have the people fighting among themselves over things that are irrelevant to policy-making decisions. You know, in a situation where Trump is rallying his constituency, his base, over a hit on Iran, people here in the United States, I'm certain Trump did know who Soleimani was, but the average person in the United States had no idea until, you know, the last few days who that was. And so, you know, we had 25, 30 years of occasional hits in Iraq in the 1990s, for example, and subsequently, and also in Afghanistan. So this is just another, oh, we bombed another one of them events here. You make the same grunts and groans out of Washington, thump your chest, and you move on. That's the only meaning I think it has. Honestly, if we wanted to just have a discussion of that in the media here, they would be talking about the looting of the cultural heritage of Iraq in the, you know, the war that took place in 2003 at SEC. And also, right. You know, walk along the Thames River in London, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, they've looted the entire planet. You have, you know, gods from this place in Africa and from this place in South America. You know, all these things that belong to people that were murdered and then their wealth carted back and set up on the Thames River or in the museums across the West and private collections. So, you know, that threat, I would take it seriously if I were Iran, but even unspoken, I would take it seriously just looking at history. It's what they do.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And in terms of, let's say, the U.S. presidential election, you know, we've been talking to our guests in the past couple of days, and they had differing opinions regarding this. Some of them believe that this would benefit Mr. Trump, and this is the trick that he was, of course, he was blaming Obama for this. When we had the video, and we aired it on Press TV here the other day, that he was blaming Obama, that he's doing this war, he's going to stage a war in order to win re-election. And some people believe that he's doing exactly that himself now. And some people believe that he's not going to be re-elected as a consequence of what he's done. What do you think?
I think it depends on how it all turns out. Look, there has been an ongoing effort to basically to have a coup against Trump since he took office. And when he came into office, they were saying that because of the emoluments clause in the Constitution, the moment he took office, he would have an emoluments problem and be subject to impeachment and should be removed right away. Mm-hmm. And there has been one thing after another. Oh, here's the kid he sat in front of in kindergarten. He passed wind, and, you know, here's his testimony. Here's his first girlfriend. He stole her bike. You know, this kind of stuff. One thing after another, why they should remove him from office. And so that has been an ongoing project anyway. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind looking at the way this is playing out here. And also, I also have some suspicions, despite the fact that he claims it now and he's owning it. Yeah, I did that, and I'm a genius for doing it. That, in fact, it may have been done by Langley or the Pentagon. He's in a position going into this election where to win Florida and, you know, some other spots, he has to own it. He can't say he's opposed to it. I mean, you see none of the Democrats say they're opposed either, just over the methodology, you know, that they didn't consult first or whatever. But the thing itself, politically, no one can say they're opposed to it. So I'm wondering, you know, you have at least three factions in Iraq between the militias that are organized under more or less the old government groups and Sunni groups, they call them here, and those that are allied with Iran, say, or the Shia groups. And then you've got the Barzanis and the, you know, people, the Kurds in the north and stuff, and all these different power centers in Iraq. You have the conflict going on in the U.S. government also. And not for nothing, this was not President Rouhani or President Ahmadinejad that was killed, and millions of Iranians are in the streets, you know, mourning him. This is obviously just a national figure that is drawing people out, but he had a special affection. If at some point in time he could be a rival to either of those, you know, who knows if someone inside the government, outside the government, that wants to be inside the government, some U.S. agent in Tehran that no one knows, whatever, there could be three different groups with multiple moving parts inside each one of them that, you know, coalesced on this particular target. The point is, where do we go now? And if we get the U.S. out of Iraq, and if suddenly Trump starts talking with Iran like he's been doing with North Korea, he might well win the presidency again, and by a bigger margin. And more important than that, although Soleimani is a martyr for sure in this case, the outcome is better for everyone in the region.
Yeah, and Mr. Dundebar, there's also this word around by CNN, which is here, that, you know, because President Trump came up and said that he had intelligence regarding General Soleimani preparing, you know, because it's called this preemptive attack. And why preemptive is that he had intelligence that Soleimani was preparing to stage an attack on U.S. targets. And now CNN and others are reporting that there is serious doubt regarding the authenticity of, you know, that intelligence. Of course, Iran outright said that there is no such a thing. Iran has never waged any war. Iran was not going to do anything like that. So skepticism is growing, you know, on the fact that on what basis President Trump decided, made up his mind, and then issued that order.
Well, again, you know, the opposition to Trump in the United States, the attempt to remove him from office, the attempt to prevent him from being elected, was centered in the intelligence agencies here. So to call it even a rivalry is a severe understatement of the condition that exists. For him to say, okay, I had intel that said so-and-so, now, and now someone from the intel community, quote-unquote, says, no, he didn't. It's a continuation of their attempt to remove him from office, perhaps, with him unable to say, you know, here's all the super secret stuff that they gave me, you know, that I don't want anybody else to see, but I got to show it to you, otherwise I won't be elected. Then they come back and say, he showed everybody the super secret stuff. I mean, you know, the problem, we have a virtual reality that people are consuming as if there were a rational policymaking apparatus at work here, rather than, you know, two factions that are duking it out over the direction of U.S. imperialism. I mean, I think that's really what we're talking about here. And so, the choice that we're presented with is, which one do we survive like the next year or two under? Do we go with the one that wants to have a war with Russia and China, or do we go with the one that is stumbling and doing God knows what, but not doing that? I mean, I think that's what we're presented with. It looks like a whole lot of other things, but that's just what's on television.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that now we have, Western media, they have all this breaking news and everything reads something like imminent threat from Iran. So it means they are expecting this. It looks like they are filled with horror. And the question is, why in the first place? I mean, someone like Trump should do this. I mean, was it really worth it, taking the risk?
There's been an imminent threat from Iran since about 1650. We're still waiting. Iran does not invade others. Certainly, they've never conducted a transcontinental aggression against anyone. So, you know, maybe running out of coffee on an airline flight once in a while. I don't know. But really, I mean, it's absurd on its face. But this is the tongue of the realm here. This has been the language of American politicians, Democrats and Republicans, and a lot of lefties too, by the way, so-called, since 1979, that, you know, there's an irrational, terrorist-leaning, religious fanatic, a group of maniacs who took over. You know, the lefties will say, you know, it's our fault because we had a rational socialist in power and took him out, put the Shah in there, and so now we get this. The rest of them were just, you know, this is something that's genetic to those people. Let's just blow them up. There's a whole, you know, I wouldn't even call it a sub-narrative in the American political culture that runs along those lines. It used to be on TV. Now it's out of style, because if they say that, then it's hard for them to call Trump, you know, a Islamophobe or whatever. I guess that's why. But the policies haven't changed. You have U.S. military occupation, directly or indirectly, of a good part of that region. I say indirectly, for example, in Saudi Arabia, they just have a puppet government there. Indirectly in Bahrain, the puppet government in Saudi Arabia is occupying Bahrain. It's a direct occupation of Iraq. There's a proxy occupation of parts of Syria dissolving as we speak, and an attempted occupation of Iran. But if you look at the borders and the U.S. military bases, of course, you got a line of soldiers around the borders with the guns pointed inward. So, you know, it's really absurd to be talking about an imminent threat from anybody except the United States, given history and the present condition. But this is just the way they, you know, that's what comes out of, on press releases out of Washington. It's their TV show that goes to the policy, which is unfortunately a lot more painful and a lot less known.
Mm-hmm. One last question, if I may. The question is, the EU, lackluster, if you will, the response regarding this. I don't remember any EU member country, you know, condemning this attack. We even had something from Germany that we didn't like to hear. And we also had, the UK was kind of worried, they say they would take any measure to protect our own military staffers. I don't protect them from what? And then we had France, for instance, the top diplomat saying that inviting Iran to exercise self-restraint, not to be provoked. And let's talk about this European reaction regarding this.
You know, the EU is subservient. Let's be honest about this. The political orientation is neoliberal, and it is pretty much the case that the leadership inside the the unelected circles, the power structure, and also the political class in general, in affinity with the same political class in the United States that was dominant up until the last presidential election. Clinton, Bush, you know, the neoliberal, neocon, accommodation, whatever. Mm-hmm. So they're positioning with certain national refinements for public relations purposes, I guess, has been more or less on that same line. No one says leave Iran alone, and this was a great man making peace, etc., in Europe. Really, no one of in any position of power outside of the left. I think maybe we see that from Corbyn, one or two others. Mm-hmm. And instead, it's couched in the same terms as the Democrats. You know, it's almost like Hood's talking points, with a little Democratic flourish on the procedural aspects of it. That, yeah, he's a terrorist. Yeah, Iran needs to be protected against, you know, we need to be protected against Iranian nukes, etc. This is counterproductive on those lines. And in addition, Congress should have been consulted. That's kind of the same sort of line that the EU's taking. And again, it's just subservient. You know, we're still having policy retribution, for example, for when Merkel found out that they were tapping her phone. Mm. You know, while they're talking about Huawei, for example, you would think that U.S. telecom companies would be completely off the table in European capitals and EU capitals when they found out that the U.S. telecom companies and the U.S. government were tapping the leadership's phones in the EU. Mm-hmm. I mean, Merkel's about as close to the top as you get in the political class in Europe.
Right.
And they're not. This is a subservient structure. I wouldn't say it necessarily is subservient to the U.S. government, but the same people who own the U.S. government own the EU as well, and there is a tremendous amount of policy coordination directly from Washington, mm-hmm, with the EU that gets implemented in Europe.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that the EU has done nothing regarding preserving the Iran nuclear deal, and they are insisting in the middle of all of this, they want Iran to stay there and not to go away.
Well, you know, I think we had a high State Department official sum up the U.S. State Department and the U.S. government's view of the leadership of the EU in that phone call between Nuland and Piatt back in 2014. I think that makes pretty clear exactly what the U.S. attitude is towards the U.S. Towards the EU.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for your comments. I should say goodbye to Don DeBar, activist and commentator who joined us from Westchester with his comments and perspective.